Text 087 69 44 500.
90.3 Near FM.
Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. Good afternoon, you're very welcome to Global Solidarity, if that's what you've tuned in for, with Tony Fitzsimons. But this week, and for the last week, it's me, Peter Carney, with International Politics, which is repeated then on Tuesdays. Tuesday from next week and Tuesday fortnight will be my regular slot, where in International Politics, we look at the world of international politics and national politics as well of international significance. I'm Peter Carney, as I said, I'm with you every fortnight on Tuesday. And of course, standing in today for Tony Fitzsimons of Global Solidarity. Significant happenings on this day, the 27th of January. Not too much really in the world of politics. 1945, a very significant event. The Red Army liberates Auschwitz, Birkenau. And in 1973, Paris Peace Accords officially ends the war in Vietnam. I was looking for some significant political birthdays today, but I couldn't find any. Of course, the most significant birthday today is my younger brother, Donal. So very happy birthday to you, Donal, if you're tuning in there somewhere along the line. And on this week's show, or rather I should say this fortnight show, lots of different events. The special event we have coming up is from an interview I did with Keith Walsh and Jill Birdsworth, Apples of the Golan. They made a film out in the Golan Heights. The informative piece is with Cathy Kelly from Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And our special feature of the week, I was up in Belfast finding out what was going on there about the British flag protests. So I was talking to five of the main parties involved there. If you want to participate, you can, as always, by texting us on 087 69 44500. That's 087 69 44500. You can call the station here at 867 1190. You can contact me on Facebook, Twitter, or Meetup. Just type in International Politics or Peter's Politics. You'll find me right there. Or email me, peter.carney2@gmail.com. Now, the Golan Heights is the area captured and occupied by Israel from Syria in the Six-Day War in 1967. Although it is internationally recognised as Syrian territory, it is disputed. Filmmakers Keith Walsh and Jill Beardsworth decided to investigate the disputed territory. So they picked up their cameras and equipment, headed to the Middle East, and made a film about the disputed territory, and the film is called Apples of the Golan. So for this fortnight special event, we're joined by Keith and Jill.
My name is Keith Walsh, one of the directors of Apples of the Golan.
And I'm Jill Beardsworth, the other director of Apples of the Golan.
Good stuff. So can you just start off by telling us why you made this film?
I suppose we made the film because, we met a guy, an Irish guy called Garrod O'Coin, who had been to the Golan Heights. He'd done some human rights research. So we met him, he told us the stories of that were there, and it kind of piqued our interest, really.
Right. Visually as well, he showed us quite a lot of photographs, because he's taken quite a lot of photographs during his research, and visually the place looked amazing, so that got us quite excited as well.
Yeah, okay. And was there any political interest in making this story, or making a film about the Golan Heights?
At the beginning, no, there wasn't. No, neither of us would have been coming to it with a political agenda at all. I suppose it was one of our intentions to not have that in it when we were making it. We kept ourselves fairly separate to that intentionally.
We kind of wanted to make an anthropological study rather than a kind of a political thesis. We when we were starting off the process, we, from what Garrod had told us, we kind of took that as enough, and we purposely consciously didn't learn all the different facts and details. We wanted to go there with the camera and let us find out. Now, although we're not visible in the documentary, it's very much an observation style, but we still wanted to go there and find out with the camera the details of the situation, rather than kind of find out all the information and then to go with an agenda. It was conscious not to go with an agenda.
Yeah, it's very difficult or challenging, I suppose, to make anything that could be remotely considered political and be completely independent. Although I found the film, as I was saying to you earlier on, kind of told its own story. It started off, I wasn't really sure what to make of it. You've this guy, I suppose in many ways you could say, indoctrinating the kids
about Assad and the glory of Syria. How do you think that stands now in light of what we apparently know about Assad and the Syrian regime?
That, you know, that love of Bashar al-Assad, that nationalism is still there. It's not, it hasn't changed for the most part within the Druze, within the Druze of the Golan Heights. The reasons for that are Druze are a minority, and in Syria they would be aligned and they would always have been aligned and treated well by the Bashar al-Assad regime. And they're, generally speaking, they're from the same strand of Islam. They're from, they're both Bashar al-Assad is Alawi, and the Druze are from, they're both of them are from the Shia Islam side. At the moment now, they are afforded a protected position under Bashar al-Assad. That would change if the rebels took over. They fear that they wouldn't be treated so well if the rebels actually took over. Yeah. So I suppose it's pragmatism, and you know they want to survive.
They're holding on.
Yeah, but yeah. There is people. There is, as you saw at the end of the film. You know, we kind of leave it with, okay, there's trouble in the camp, and that's going to take some time to evolve. But what's there at the moment is there is 100 to 150 people who will publicly come out against Bashar al-Assad, but they are suffering now because they're not invited to weddings, funerals. They're completely excommunicated from the rest of the village because they're coming out against Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah.
So there's kind of like a tentative peace now. They're kind of just waiting.
Yeah, would they be among the same group of people who would have accepted Israeli citizenship? Because it was said in the film as well that they are pretty much excluded from the Syrian society within the Golan Heights if you take Israeli citizenship.
Yeah, it probably will be made up of those people as well as the younger people.
Yeah.
People who would be a bit more, I suppose, connected to Western culture. People who'd be a bit more liberal maybe in their thinking, wouldn't be so traditional.
Yeah.
And there probably are more than, like, say, the 100, 150 that you spoke about, but they wouldn't have come out publicly and said it. Yeah. So there's probably, you know, more than that who would be anti-Bashar but just wouldn't be so comfortable coming out in the street and saying it for fear of the boycotting that Keith spoke about.
Yeah. And for fear as well. They're all at the end of the day thinking about what's going to happen if back to Syria. If they go back to Syria and they have all come out against Bashar al-Assad, and if Bashar al-Assad stays in, which he could, it's not a guarantee that he's going to be ousted.
Yeah.
You know, if they go back and they have supported the rebels, well, then it isn't going to be a happy end. I think stopping him from being ousted is that they don't know what the other option is.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that struck me about the film, or rather the characters in the film, that for me the young people seemed disinterested in being pro-Syrian, which my own opinion of what I've seen in other conflicts is usually the younger people are more enthusiastic about fighting a revolution, whereas in this one it was the older people who seemed to be interested in it. And as well as that, a couple of them, maybe it's connected, they seemed apathetic. They were kind of thinking, well, look, at the Syrian regime before the Israeli takeover wasn't entirely above board either, so it doesn't really matter. It's like I got the impression from them that they just didn't care either way, you know. Did you get the same impression yourselves?
Yeah, from quite a lot of the young people. I suppose one of the things that has the younger people in a difficult situation is they don't have any citizenship. Their citizenship is undefined, so they can't travel without an awful lot of hassle.
A couple of them even said we're nothing, you know.
Yeah, which is, pretty much. Like it says undefined on their travel document, which isn't even a passport. You know, it's like something that's used like a laissez-passer. It's used for animals and stuff, you know. So it's quite demeaning for them to have this identity card rather than an actual passport, and that's because their fathers and grandfathers refused Israeli citizenship during the strike. So that would probably have a lot of the younger people feeling quite, I suppose, maybe a bit of animosity towards the generation above them that were very, very pro-Syrian. And as well as that, they're, you know, they have the internet, they, you know, they're exposed to Western culture, they're exposed to Israeli culture, and you know there's rappers, there's salsa dancers as you saw in the film, there's you know, Western culture is there very much so. The girls wear, you know, sleeveless tops and short dresses and stuff, and you know that's
the thing. I mean, it isn't actually a liberal society, but it has, I mean, the religious people are very conservative and try to hold on to it, but the young people are very liberal and the old people are very conservative.
It's important to say, like, in other Druze cultures, women particularly wouldn't be allowed to wear earrings, for example. They would wear long dresses. They wouldn't be as liberal as the girls, for example, would be in the Golan Heights. Women can drive and they can, you know, they don't have to wear headdress or whatever, but they're a lot more liberal in the Golan Heights.
I think, you know, the young people don't have anything to fight against. The Israeli army are not on the streets. They drive up and down every now and again, but there's no checkpoints. It's under civil law, so there's nothing there to actually fight against.
It's still technically speaking a disputed territory, isn't it?
Yes. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's under international law. It's a legal occupation, even though Israel have annexed, essentially, without using the word annexation, they've annexed it, and it's under Israeli civil law, so, which is completely illegal. But there's nothing to fight against, so the young people don't have, they don't have checkpoints or people to throw stones at or whatever.
Yeah.
It isn't done there. So in a sense, you know, if you don't have anything to fight against, then you can, it's very easy to be apathetic to it, even though they all want to, I think they all feel themselves as Arab. So if you were to ask them, where would you prefer, you know, where would your allegiance lie, it would lie in Syria. But in Israel, the way they are at the moment, there's a lot of money. They eat a lot of meat, they eat a lot of steaks. You know, they're well off. So between not having anything to fight against and having a lot of money, it's easy for apathy to...
It's a bizarre situation. I mean, on the one hand, it's like there's no violence and so on and so forth, but it's like, what do we do here? As was mentioned in the film by the Syrians living in the Golan Heights, they said if anybody takes up Israeli citizenship, that they're boycotted. And did you see any evidence of that yourselves in making the film, or what form did it take?
Fief and his son would be the main one. Characters in the film, it's an older gentleman, a fief. He owns a coffee shop, and his son married a non-Druze. She was Ukrainian Christian, so he married outside of his sect,
right?
And that's considered similar to, it's kind of breaking the Druze rules. So he and his family were then boycotted. His son happened to die in a car crash and wasn't allowed to be buried in the Druze cemetery. He was buried kind of outside of it,
as you've probably
seen the film,
which
is a big blow to a family, to have one of their family members not buried with the rest of them.
It affects their chances when they're reincarnated in their next life.
And overall, did you find it an easy film to make?
No.
It's very
unanimously no.
Right.
It was quite difficult.
Yeah. Right. What made it difficult?
There were a number of things, I suppose, that made it difficult. The complexity of the region.
Right.
Made it difficult because we were figuring stuff out as we went along, because Keith mentioned a lot about them being quite secretive, and they were quite open to us, but it just took a while for us to be trusted enough to actually, for ourselves, to really find out what was going on.
Right.
You know, we were kind of fed the political rhetoric at the beginning, the first couple of trips, and then we started to figure out, okay, there's more going on here than just what we're being told. So it took quite a while to figure that out. And of course, that the language was also made it quite difficult, because neither of us were fluent Arabic when we went there. I mean, we've an idea of Arabic now, but we weren't able to speak directly to the people at the beginning. We were there over a period of 4 years. We probably spent about 9 months there. Five or six different trips. We usually would go and spend a month there. I think 2 months was probably the most we spent. And then other trips, maybe of 3 weeks, 2 weeks, whatever. So we were filming, we were talking to people, interviewing them, and then it might take a while for us to get translation. Right. Back, because their particular dialect is a difficult enough dialect, so not every Arabic speaker can translate it.
Right.
So we needed to get translators from the area.
Yeah.
That might take a couple of weeks, because things happen slowly over there. So we wouldn't normally be back in Ireland before we actually could figure out what people were saying.
Right.
Then it would take another trip to re-interview them or ask them more.
Yeah.
That was quite a difficulty. The language.
Okay.
I think essentially, like we were making a documentary in a secretive society that is infiltrated by spies in a very security conscious place. So it isn't a fertile ground for a foreign crew coming in to make a documentary that isn't about what they want to talk about. Yeah. It's about kind of their lives and about what, you know. So it was a challenge, and seemingly, I mean, you know, we were told that back in the early 80s there was an Irish person who had been in the village who was learning Arabic, who seemingly turned out to be a spy for the Israelis. Now, that was just alleged. It took a long while to get the trust of the people.
Right.
And that came from going back the second time, the third time. And then when we went back, like, I think we might have gone there 7 times or 8 times. So by the time the sixth or seventh or eighth time, when there was no film, they were like, okay, what's the story here? You keep coming back and you're making a film, but where is the film? So again, the suspicion at the end, it kind of felt like, okay, we need to finish this now.
So Apples of the Golan, where can people get a look at it? I know there's a show on in the Chester Beatty as well.
Library on the second February,
two p.m.
Right. Okay. And then after that, then we would hope to release it on our website at some point.
Yeah. It will be available online within the next few months.
Good stuff. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Apples of the Golan, indeed, well worth checking out. As I said, it's going to be online soon. There's showing on in the Chester Beatty on the 2nd of February. Okay, so on to our informative piece of the fortnight. Voices for Creative Nonviolence has deep, long-standing roots in active nonviolent resistance to US warmaking. Kathy Kelly has just returned from Afghanistan and has spent time in many different trouble spots around the world. She's one of the coordinators of Voices for Creative Nonviolence and joins us this week for this fortnight's informative piece to tell us about their work. you're with a group called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And
We used to be Voices in the Wilderness.
Uh-huh.
And we broke the sanctions as often as we could. And really, at this point, I sort of wish we kept the old name. It's true we didn't end the economic sanctions, and it's true we believe that we have a responsibility to practice nonviolence by trying to end wars in the United States and engage in civil disobedience and war tax refusal. But we never feel like we have any role whatsoever in going over to other countries and telling them how to practice nonviolence. We just want to try to restrain the United States' cruelty.
So is that's your the objective of Voices for Creative Nonviolence? It's to withhold, or as you said, restrict powers such as the USA going into places to make war in the first place, rather than going into a place like Afghanistan or somewhere else and saying, guys, this is how you make peace.
Oh, right. The latter is not what we're about. We do think it's important to try to live alongside ordinary people and learn from them and listen to them. And that the kind of nonviolence we should practice is everything. It has everything to do with living simply and sharing resources and trying to be of service. And we sure learn a lot about that when we're living with the Afghan peace volunteers.
Now, it's been on the go since about 2005.
We started in 1996 with Voices in the Wilderness, and then we changed our name in 2005.
Days on your side, that you've learned nonviolent grassroots movements to raise awareness about the negative impacts of US militarism in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. So is that the area that you guys focus in mainly, or would you go beyond those regions?
Well, I was in Gaza, and so was Josh Brolier. We booked our tickets when we thought the bombing was still going on, but by the time we got there, the ceasefire had been declared. But I'd been in Gaza in 2009 during the bombing, and we've also been in Lebanon during the Israeli Hezbollah war and traveled to the southern villages and towns after that war. And we were in Iraq all through the Shenandoah bombing. We've tried very hard to work on the issue of drones and educating people about drones. So one of our co-coordinators is in prison for 6 months right now, and we've each taken our turn doing actions and going to jail. But most of us, I mean, just 3 and 4 days lately. But most of us have been to jail for substantial lengths of time. I did a year in maximum security for planting corn on nuclear weapons, and 3 months for crossing the line at a military base. And we don't pay taxes to the U.S. government, so we like to support one another in living simply.
You went to Gaza for 2009 when the bombing started. So what exactly do you do when you're there?
Well, I think it's a good idea to listen very carefully to what people are saying and to see if people in the United States can't be reached by voices that they might not otherwise hear. I mean, it just happened that a Palestinian doctor who'd grown up one neighborhood away from me was in the emergency room at the Al-Shifa Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so I had a chance to ask him, you know, what happened? And he told me all of these gruesome, terrible stories. And then I said, okay, what exactly should I say to people back in your neighborhood? I'll go. And I know where their community center is. And what do you want me to say? And he was saying, well, say we don't have prostheses and say we don't have ways to deal with these dense inert metal explosive bombs, and we can't deal with the white phosphorus in our emergency rooms. And then he said, no, I'm completely wrong. Just you tell them U.S. taxpayers paid for these weapons. Mm-hmm. So if I hadn't been there, I wouldn't have, you know, delivered that story. So we think it is important to be alongside people.
Yeah, so when you're in an area like Gaza or Afghanistan, when you see something happening, do you report it back, or do you wait till you're back in the States before you tell people about it?
No. We do everything we can to get it out as fast as we can. Now, the mainstream media, you know, NPR has just been adamant, we'll never give your group a platform. So we don't try to annoy them. Democracy Now! Or Brit TV, some of the alternative TV, readily takes our reports. And, you know, we make sure we edit each other's work. And if I put something out, it's almost sure to go up to 67 different websites, and I'm satisfied that, you know, we're reaching some people, not be part of the choir, but we know we really must challenge one another to get beyond the choir. We know that. I think we have to do much more to try to reach the people in the upper echelons of the major corporations. I'm very open to suggestions about how to do that, but
So how do you convince them of that, Kathy? Because a lot of people on that side of the fence might say, look, we need these weapons to protect America's interests overseas. That old expression was used in in Israel and Palestine. If the Palestinians put down their weapons, we have peace. If the Israelis put down their weapons, we've no Israel. So people might be working off that fear. Like, if we put down our weapons, people are going to wipe us out. How do you counter that fear?
Well, you know, I often quote a writer whose reports, while he was an embedded soldier with a U.S. squadron doing night raids, appeared in a magazine called The American Scholar. It's not a left-wing magazine at all. And he was embedded for quite some time with soldiers. He fictitiously called them the destroyer unit. And he writes about how these soldiers in night raids would tornado through houses and break people's plates and throw their furniture around and hurl the people within the house against the walls and hogtie the householder and cart people off to prison. Just a nightmare.
Yeah.
And then he quotes the Staff Sergeant Givens, and that's a fictitious name also. And he says that Staff Sergeant Givens said, you know, we spent a week recruiting for the Taliban out here. And I hope your listeners get that they had just spent a week recruiting for the Taliban, because every villager would be so angry. They would want to join the Taliban. And then he said, and you know what? He said, we had fun doing it. I like recruiting for the Taliban. It's job security. And right now, the United States is building on 10 acres, a new camp called Camp Integrity. And it will be used to train people to do just this, these night raids. And the people building the camp and who will supervise the training are the Blackwater Corporation. And I don't know if your listeners might be familiar with Blackwater, but they were very notorious as security contractors for having shot down Iraqi civilians in Nisar Square. And they were convicted for killing Afghan civilians. They were also convicted of stealing weapons from the United States military and selling them. So they've changed their name. Their name now is Academy.
Right.
But, you know, this isn't going to make us more secure in the world. Yeah. And also now the United States says that its partners in a plan for peace, a roadmap for peace in Afghanistan, will be Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Turkey, Qatar, and Britain. Now, what kind of sense does this make to link up with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and say that's how they're going to create peace in Afghanistan?
Yeah. So the whole security thing is a nonsense. It's an industry.
It surely is, and it's the main industry in the United States. The military-industrial, congressional media complex has one stranglehold on all the jobs, and another stranglehold is now the increasing security prison industry. And they'd like us to think that this creates jobs. It doesn't. If you took the same amount of money and invested it in retrofitting the housing stock or building mass transit, transportation, or taking care of the elderly, you would create 4,000 more jobs for whatever sum of money you want to look at. So U.S. people aren't informed of this. They're told, look, if you want to be interested in something, pick the Super Bowl or the Emmy or the Oscars or your kids' soccer league or something that has to do with sports and entertainment. Don't even bother thinking about politics, because you can't do anything about it anyway.
What can you tell us about life on the ground in Afghanistan?
You know, the infrastructure is pretty terrible. And so when the electricity goes out, I mean, there are other countries that have worse electrical outages in their capital cities, I know. But when the pipes are frozen and you have maybe a 10 or 12 hour electrical outage, then you don't have any water. And we were so lucky. We had a roof over our heads. We had wood and coal to put in a heater. We could sleep on the floor with many blankets. We had food. But I myself began to worry. You know, you've got a stand-up toilet and 20 people using it. When there's no water, how are you going to, you know, prevent cholera? And because we were all in one room, because it was the only heated room, and I, for instance, had pneumonia, and I think quite a few others did, you know, we all just circulated each other's germs. And that's what happens in household after household. So people in the wintertime, their immunities are down, and then they can't afford vegetables because they aren't being grown as crops in the winter. So the diet is usually bread and rice and maybe some beans and tea without sugar. And that's not enough to help people build immunities. One out of every five Afghan children doesn't make it beyond the age of five. One of every 11 women dies in childbirth. The average life expectancy for women is somewhere between 42 and 45 years of age. For men, it seems now to be going up between 45 and 49. It's a very rough life. of the poverty measurements says that 36% of the people are below the poverty line, but we think it could be many, many more. And then in terms of mental illness and post-traumatic stress, oh my goodness, I don't know anybody who's not suffering real traumas from having fled or been displaced or lived in a refugee camp, or the hospitals are just wretched, many of them. You know, people, when they are hospitalized, have to bring their own sheets and pillowcases and food and caregivers and medicines. So you can imagine the hospitals are kind of a mess. They're not orderly and tidy by any means. And then there's a lot of corruption. If you want to get anything, you have to pay bribes. And so that also affects how much the government can do. The government leaders are despised really by many of the people because so many of them are warlords. And Karzai kind of had to put them into governance because otherwise they would have killed him.
Kathy Kelly from Voices for Creative Nonviolence, thanks very much for joining us and telling us all about your organization and what you've seen happening on the ground. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you very much.
And again, thank you very much to Kathy Kelly for joining us. The organization is Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and the website is vcnv.org. That's vcnv.org. And Kathy did say that the British branch of VCNV were particularly looking to recruit Irish volunteers. So if you're interested, check it out, vcnv.org, and you can find out a little bit more about what it is that they do. It's amazing work that they do there. And I would like to thank Kathy once again for joining us on Skype, as you might have worked out that that interview was done by the week previous to that. I made contact with Kathy while she was in Afghanistan, and we tried to do a Skype link up there, but it kept dropping on us every minute, so it didn't really work out. So that one was done when Kathy got back to base camp in New York. So check it out, Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Then the website is vcnv.org, and Keith Walsh and Jill Beardsworth's film Apples of the Golan, I think that's the website as well, applesofthegolan.com. You can Google it anyway. And they have an upcoming showing of it in the Chester Beatty on the 2nd of February. It may be sold out, but check it out anyway. Okay, so in a couple of minutes, we're going to take a break. And after that, we're going to have my special feature of the week, or the fortnight, I should say. I keep saying the week because it's a fortnightly show. The special feature of the fortnight is the Belfast riots. During the week, I went up to Belfast to find out what was going on. I met with a couple of the parties up there. I met with the SDLP and the Alliance when I was up there, and then a couple of the other parties I met with, or rather I linked up with on the phone when I came back. So I spoke to five of the main parties, after the break they'll be played in this order. We'll just go straight into it. It's Jim McVeigh, who's a Sinn Féin councillor, David McElveen, who's a DUP MLA, Conal McDevitt, who's the SDLP MLA, Laura McNamee, who's an Alliance Party councillor in East Belfast, and Winston Irvine of the PUP. I'll be speaking to all of them after the break. So as you know, on the 3rd of December, a democratic majority of councillors on Belfast City Council voted to restrict the number of days the British flag flies over Belfast City Hall, bringing Belfast into line with the Stormont Parliament building and many other councils around Northern Ireland. Since the vote has passed, over 127 police officers have been injured and over 174 people have been arrested. Some of them are currently going to court in the mainly loyalist rioting. So why has a democratic vote led to so much violence? As I said, I headed to Belfast to find out a little bit more about that, and after the break we'll be going straight into it.
Download a podcast and catch up on your listening at near.ie.
Near FM.
The Brief, legal current affairs show every Thursday night at 7 o'clock. Presented by Barristers at Law, Andrew Robinson and Peter Leonard. We offer legal advice, comment on the legal issues of the day. If any questions or queries for comments for the show, email us at askthebrief@near.ie. That's The Brief, legal current affairs show every Thursday at 7 o'clock.
It's not always easy to find time to listen to Near FM, but now with our catch-up service, you can just click and listen again. Log on to near.ie and download the latest podcast. Some programmes are available in full. Listen again to our selection of local news, views and current affairs, arts, culture and drama. Log on to near.ie, click listen again and bring Near FM with you wherever you are. Got a smartphone? Download our programmes from near.ie. PC, laptop, download from near.ie. Near FM. Just click and listen again.
Mature heads.
Rockers.
Hippies and
goths.
Relive those teenage years
with the music of the Grove.
Every Friday from 10 to the end with me, Peter Gaynor.
And me, Lynn Kavanagh.
On The Grove Show.
Here on Near FM.
I think it sounds slowed down just a little bit.
For an independent voice on international politics and world affairs, tune in to International Politics every Tuesday fortnight from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. with Peter Carney. Hear the unheard voices, the challenging of conventional opinions, and a diversity of opinions related to world events and politics every Tuesday fortnight from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. with Peter Carney on Near FM.
Intelligent debate, specialist music, your community station.
90.3 Near FM.
Between the DUP and the Alliance Party in East Belfast, and that goes some way to explain the role of the main unionist leaders in this controversy as well. There are some National Front people involved in orchestrating the campaign, and there are some loyalist paramilitaries involved. So there's a whole series of reasons as to why some people are organising the protests.
Right. So when you say National Front, you mean members of the BNP in Britain?
That's right, yes. Okay. A very prominent BNP supporter speaking at some of the rallies outside the City Hall. Well, there's no doubt that there have been elements of the UVF have been involved in orchestrating some of the violence and orchestrating some of the protests. I'm not so sure that the UVF as a collective leadership have made a decision to support this, but certainly personalities have been heavily involved. And unfortunately as well, politicians associated with UVF, people like Billy Hutchinson, have played a sort of malign role in whipping up sectarian fears around this matter. 3 weeks before the decision on the flag in the City Hall, the PEP's stated policy position was to support the position of flying the flag on designated days. So
right.
3 weeks before the decision was taken, the PEP rather opportunistically changed their position to oppose the compromise decision that we took on the 3rd of December. So there was a very cynical piece of party political electioneering adopted by the PUP of elements associated with the UVF, and unfortunately they played their part in whipping up some of the fears and some of the hysteria around this issue, which has been responsible for bringing people out on the streets and causing some of the violence.
Right.
With a ludicrous situation where for 12 years now one unionist complained about the very policy that we adopted in Belfast City Council for 12 years, and yet for some reason or another, and we can guess what those reasons are, they decided to whip up fears around the decision to fly the flag in the same number of days in Belfast City Hall, for all the wrong reasons, we would say, of course.
Yeah.
What we needed, of course, was responsible, mature, calm leadership from the main political unionist parties, from Peter Robinson and Mike Nesbitt. But what we got instead was politicians following the mob, and unfortunately contributing to the hysteria around this matter. Instead of telling their supporters and telling the people in places like East Belfast, well, in actual fact, the decision we took was a reasonable decision, that it was not an attack upon their Britishness. What we're trying to do by decisions like this is create a city for everyone. This is about equality. It's about mutual respect. All that we want. We have a city now in Belfast which is the majority are probably people from a nationalist Irish background. And what we're trying to do is create a city hall, a civic space, where every tradition, whether British tradition, but also the Irish tradition, can be respected.
Now, there's a lot of talk around the leaflets that were distributed in East Belfast, 40,000 or so leaflets, I'm not sure exactly how many, asking people or inviting people to contact the Alliance Party to express their dissatisfaction with them. What role do you think those leaflets played in, maybe not in the protest, but either in the protest themselves or whipping it up into violence?
Well, I think they've had a direct burn upon a subsequent events. I mean, the DUP, along with the official unions as well, distributed 40,000 leaflets just in East Belfast.
Mm.
That tells you something about the motivation behind the initiative and yeah. some of the politics at the heart of this dispute. Of course, the city MP for East Belfast is Naomi Long from the Alliance Party.
Mm.
That is Peter Robinson's former constituency. There is a battle taking place between the DUP and the Unionist parties and Alliance for that seat in the elections that we're looking into. One of the subtext of the text as well is that there's been a number of inquiries into collusion between the old RUC and loyalist paramilitaries, particularly UVF,
uh-huh.
in various parts of Belfast, and one of their colleagues, Amon Cody, is currently in protective custody and is believed about to give evidence against some of his former comrades in the UVF, and we've been led to believe that there's a real fear within the leadership of the UVF that arrests will be pending, and people may find themselves in prison as a consequence of his evidence. So there is a view that part of the logic around the involvement of the UVF and stoking up some of this stuff is to sort of almost like put a warning down to the police and to others that look, you know, don't go down the road of arresting people, don't go down the road of charging people around historical crimes.
Well, I think, Peter, there are two major issues here. I mean, I think, first of all, we have to be very clear that violence of any type against the police or against anyone else is never justified. That said, I think we have to accept the fact that there was an utterly disastrous decision taken by the City Council around the removal of the flag. Now, I do accept that this is democracy in action, but what was particularly disastrous was the timing.
Now, why do you say that? Okay, obviously we can take into account the timing, but surely this just brings Belfast City Council into line with other councils in the rest of Northern Ireland in terms of flying the flag.
Well, I mean, there is an argument that that is the case, but I think what we have to come back to, Peter, is that the status quo was not causing major offence to anybody. I mean, Belfast City Council carried out a survey amongst their staff before they even brought this issue to the council agenda, and there certainly was no overwhelming sign of great offence being caused by the flag flying.
But that was among the staff. But surely, regardless of the timing, though, surely regardless of the timing, if it's just bringing Belfast into line with other councils in Northern Ireland, why should there be a problem? Surely the leaders of unionism and loyalism should be saying to their people, look guys, this is no big deal, this is just what everybody else in Northern Ireland's doing.
If we take one of my councils in my constituency in Ballymena, the flag flies 365 days a year, so we could say that Belfast was in line with Ballymena. You could also argue that when you look at other councils such as Newry, for example, that it's out of step with it. I mean, this is a free vote, it's a free issue. Belfast City Council, I as a Democrat, whether I like the decision or not, accept that Belfast City Council took the decision that they took. I don't like the decision. I lobbied against it along with party colleagues.
Sure.
However, you know, the decision was taken. But where council did have a real choice was around when this particular vote would be taken.
Mm.
I mean, as I say, the status quo was working perfectly well. There was not any great sign of offence being caused by the Union Jack flying over what is the capital of Northern Ireland in the main civic building. So, you know, I think that's a question that really would have to be put to those who chose for it to be.
Now, you say there was no big deal and there was no offence with the Union flag flying over Belfast City Hall, but clearly there was if a majority of the councillors in Belfast City Council voted to restrict it. Surely you could understand that, particularly the SDLP and Sinn Féin, who value their Irishness, surely you can respect, I'm not saying you need to agree with it, but you could respect that the flying of the Union flag could offend their sense of Irishness.
Well, I mean, I think this is where the next local government election will tell a very interesting story, because really what we do have to accept is that the demographics sometimes within a council chamber do not necessarily reflect the demographics of the city or the area at large. And the reality is that this has highlighted some issues that I as a unionist have to get a hold of, and that is the fact that there is a huge amount of voter apathy, particularly within inner city Belfast in what would be regarded as unionist areas. Now, I think in many ways those nationalist councillors that drive this agenda forward, I think they're going to get a shock. I mean, I think some people have looked at Belfast City Council over the last number of elections and almost looked at it as being a sort of a gone past the point of any return as far as there ever being a unionist majority within Belfast City Council.
Now, what do you say to the accusations that the DUP stoke this up in terms of the protests on the street going to the extent that they did? In particular, I'm drawing reference to the leaflet that was distributed around East Belfast calling on people to make their views known to the Alliance Party.
We did not ask people to come out in an act of civil disobedience, although civil disobedience in itself, I think, has been proved to work in the past. We certainly did not ask people to come out and riot and throw all manner of objects at the police. We certainly did not ask for that, but we did ask people to engage in a democratic process, make their will and their feelings known to their elected representatives, particularly those within the Alliance Party who you know, I admit, were faced with a relatively difficult decision within the council.
Yeah, no,
we asked them to engage in democracy. We didn't ask them to engage in violence.
Yeah, no, sure. Obviously, I can take your point on that. There was a little bit more than just things being thrown at the police. I mean, the police, the PSNI said they were in no doubt at all that the shots fired at them were by the UVF, members of the UVF. Surely that's a breach of the ceasefire.
There will obviously have to be a gathering of evidence around that. And certainly we will await the outcome of that. So I don't really think anybody can say for sure that there has been a breach of any ceasefire.
There are lots of things. But fundamentally, I think the most honest answer I could give you is that they're about a stunt which the DUP tried to pull with the support of the Ulster Unionist Party in Belfast City Hall that backfired. The DUP and the Ulster Unionist Party saw the vote on the flag as an opportunity to try and pincer the Member of Parliament for East Belfast, the Alliance Party's Naomi Long, and to put her in the dock, if you like, for betraying some of her electorate. And it's got out of control. Mm-hmm. And they're now paying the price for that. But this is not, in my opinion, fundamentally about social disadvantage in working class loyalist areas. It's not about a crisis in identity amongst the unionist community. It's not about some of the legacy issues to do with former paramilitaries. It's about the DUP wanting that Westminster seat back and being willing to do whatever they think they need to do to get it back. That's rather disgraceful.
Yeah. That's quite an enormous thing to do, to win back one seat. Now, I know every seat's vital, but would they really be doing that just to dislodge her from her seat?
Well, let me put it in context. You know, over the past 4 months, previous to the vote in City Hall, they put 40,000 leaflets out across Belfast City. They made these leaflets look as if they were Alliance Party leaflets.
Right.
And the leaflets targeted the Alliance Party and Naomi Long as being traitors.
Right.
And they encouraged people to phone up Naomi Long's office to protest, to, if you like, single her out for special treatment.
Mm.
And no one can say that having put 40,000 leaflets out, stoking up an awful lot of anger in a kind of an underhandy sort of a way, because they didn't say on the leaflet this is a DUP or Ulster Unionist Party leaflet. They said nothing about that. It was an anonymous leaflet.
Right.
That you could then think that you bear no responsibility for what happened once the vote went through. I mean, they stoked this up. And they stoked this up because they're still hurting about losing the seat. You've got to remember, this isn't any DUP seat. This is Peter Robinson's seat.
Mm.
Naomi Long defeated Peter Robinson at the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
And he isn't a particularly good loser. And it's really quite sad that someone who is First Minister of the North, who has rightly been acclaimed for having risen to the office of First Minister with a degree of statesmanship, you know, for having stood shoulder to shoulder with Martin McGuinness as Deputy First Minister, you know, when soldiers and police officers were being shot, for having really stepped out of what people thought was the baggage of his history, you know, and having showed some positive leadership. It's a real disappointment that he would then engage in this type of antics. Mm-hmm.
The whole issue off the flag as to how many days it can fly over Belfast City Council Hall, apart from the fact that there's so much damage that's been caused in the meantime, in many respects, it never should have taken place, because really it's only bringing Belfast into line with other councils in the north of Ireland, isn't that right?
That's correct, yeah. And with here, with Stormont.
With Stormont,
yeah. We're in at the moment, yeah.
So how did that little fact get lost?
Well, I think this is a proof point or evidence of the fact that this really isn't substantially about the Union flag. It's about all sorts of other things. I mean, the facts of the matter are that by demanding that the flag fly 365 days in Belfast City Hall, both the Ulster Unionist Party and the DUP are engaging in a U-turn. because they accepted flying on solely designated days, which is about 18 or 19, practically everywhere else in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And that's strange. That causes people to wonder what's really going on. And it is at odds not only with what happens elsewhere here in the north, it's utterly at odds with what happens in Great Britain. In fact, it's at odds with the official advice from an organisation called the College of Arms, which is the branch of the Royal Household, which advises on the protocol around the Union flag. And they say that the flag should be shown, should be flown by exception.
Now, during the protests, as we saw, and the police said that they were in no doubt that when shots were fired at them, and some of the organisers were members of the UVF and whatnot, is that not a clear breach of the ceasefire?
Absolutely.
And how come they're not being pulled up in it? Because I recall that whenever Republicans were involved in as much as a post office robbery, which is clearly not right, the whole peace process was almost brought to a halt.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be made known.
There is real annoyance at the moment here north of the border about what people perceive to be differential policing. And I would suggest that that annoyance goes beyond the nationalist community. I'd suggest there's lots of, you know, unionists, just people who are going and looking at the situation in East Belfast and going, what's going on here? They're asking themselves, how come you have no members of the UVF clearly instigating violence, clearly involved directly in violence, and how can this have no impact either on the status of the ceasefire or certainly on their ability to remain at large?
This is, yes, I mean, the IRA have effectively disbanded. I mean, the individuals haven't disappeared, but as an organisation, even though it never officially existed, it has disbanded. Yet people, community leaders and police are in open communication with these people. Surely those organisations should have disappeared a long time ago.
They absolutely should have, and quite a few of these people are out on licence. They're on conditional release.
The vast majority of people didn't even know a flag was flying, let alone how often.
Right.
That is until the DUP and the Australian Unionist Party had undertaken a leafletting campaign across North, South and East Belfast, strategically targeting predominantly loyalist, extremely hardline unionist areas, in order to, I suppose, in their attempt was to garner a bit of support. Being cynical about it, they made clear reference to Naomi Long MP on the back of the leaflet, which we take to be a reference to the fact that our party colleague at Naomi Long MP had taken one of their Westminster seats off them from Peter Robinson at the last election, and very much this was a campaign on their part to stir up tensions at the very least, and try and put people against our party. I suppose they deliberately misrepresented our party position, and certainly we have looked into that in terms of what action might be taken with regard to that. But I suppose what you have is 40,000 odd leaflets going out just before this gets brought to council, and lo and behold, protests are popping up left, right and centre. We understand people's anger. They disagree with the decision. That's fair enough. But we would stress that this was a democratic process.
Now, it has been said that before the vote was taken, that the PUP had indicated that they were going to vote the same way. But a couple of weeks beforehand, they changed their mind. Is that information that you have?
Well, certainly, the last time this came up at the council, and I would stress this predates my time on Belfast City Council, but approximately 10 years ago, the PUP had supported a position of designated days. The Ulster Unionist Party had also, and certainly the DUP implicitly support that position on other councils across Northern Ireland.
Now, as you mentioned, that Naomi Long's name was mentioned very clearly on those leaflets, and that she took the Westminster seat off Peter Robinson at the last election. Both that and the leaflets would indicate, what some people have said to me, that the DUP were trying to stoke things up. Would they really want a seat so badly that they would be responsible for such protests that turn violent?
Well, I mean, I suppose that's a question to put to them, but, you know, I mean, that is our analysis of it, that is our reading of things. You know, they've said that they did not call people out on the streets, and the wording of the leaflet, they don't call people out on the streets, but by whipping people up into such a frenzy, by deliberately misrepresenting our party position, it goes without saying. I mean, you'd have to be very naive not to expect that to then turn around as anger and hatred directed towards our party. And
now, of course, those leaflets, people could get a look at them. It's a picture on it before with a picture of the Union Jack in Belfast City Hall, and after, yeah, with no Union Jack. And on the back of it, it uses inflammatory language such as "tear down the flag," which is likely to incite other people. Now, what has it been like for you yourself? Now, we know that Naomi Long has received threats. And what has it been like for yourself and the rest of you at the Alliance Party offices there in East Belfast?
So I would describe what I had received as something of a veiled threat, making reference to holding protests outside my property where I live, and I would very much take those seriously. Most of the protests, as it happens, well, every day, they have been held outside our office, and actually today they held two protests outside our office at different times. Obviously, for our staff members who play no role in this at all, they're literally just there to serve constituents in East Belfast. It has been somewhat intimidating. Mostly the protests have been peaceful, they've been quiet, but every now and again there has been a bit of verbal abuse, I would say, and we have a very heavy police presence as well, which, suffice to say, doesn't make our office the most welcoming to people coming in from the street. And I suppose,
now, it has been said, and at one stage the PSNI were in no doubt at all that the UVF were involved in these protests and in the protests going violent, and there was allegations of shots being fired, and at the time the PSNI said they were in no doubt that the UVF were behind it. Where does that leave the position of the UVF and their political representatives in the PUP in the political process?
I mean, that is a very pointed question. It's absolutely right to ask it. You know, within Belfast as a whole, there's this sort of standoff between West Belfast versus East Belfast UVF. All the press reports that we've seen indicate that the leadership has just lost control, they've gone rogue, they're doing their own thing. And, you know, my reading of it is what we're seeing is a power struggle being played out, and certainly anecdotal evidence that's come through to us from constituents who live in the middle of all of this, you know, that would seem to substantiate our suspicions as to what's going on, that, you know, that there's maybe internal feuding going on, and it's a power struggle, essentially, maybe a show of strength, if you wanted to call it that. You know, they're intimidating people in their own area, they're burning cars out.
The issue of the flag only became an issue when Sinn Féin returned almost 13 new councillors into this term.
But Winston, would you not see that those 13 councillors that you mentioned, they were democratically elected, and they're elected by people who want their Irishness recognised, and surely the flying of a flag over the City Hall 365 days of the year, where it doesn't happen in very many other councils in Northern Ireland or the UK, that is offensive, and it gets in the way of their feeling of Irishness.
Let me refute your assertion that the flam of the Union flag is offensive.
They might see that.
Comment is unhelpful.
No, but that's how they might see it.
Yeah, but it's not the way the vast majority of citizens in Northern Ireland see it. The fact of the matter is that flag represents the constitutional and political reality, and it also reflects the sovereignty of Northern Ireland as an integral part, an integral region within the United Kingdom.
But would you not accept as well that the Union flag doesn't fly any more than 18, 19 days in many other city councils around, so why would Belfast be any different?
Well, Belfast have had that flag policy for 365 for quite some time. You've got to show respect, and you got to have dignity afforded to those who are different from you.
And has dignity and respect always been afforded to those who value their Irishness?
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of instances right across the political divide, social divide, economic divide, and environmental divide that we could all point to and say, well, yeah, you know, respect wasn't shown in that circumstance, or, you know, dignity wasn't afforded in this scenario, and that's fair enough. I think that
But it was quite strong against people who supported their Irishness. In fact, a lot of it was state sponsored. And while, of course, there was a lack of respect was also shown to people who value their Britishness, it was state sponsored disrespect.
Let's take the state sponsored argument that you pose, and let's take the Irish Republic. You know, let's remember the Irish state. Had Vatican law incorporated into their constitution. You know, if you were a Protestant born in Southern Ireland, you had no choice what your belief system was going to be. You were made to grow up through Catholic teachings. So, you know,
I think that's going off the point slightly. I don't think that's true because there's quite a number of Protestant schools in the Republic that from which their beliefs were supported. But in any case, we wanted to talk about the protests in Belfast.
You know what I'm talking about.
Well, I'm not really, because I've never experienced anybody in the South being forced to become a Catholic because they were Protestant. And in any case, there's several schools.
Brought up.
I haven't come across too many cases of that. But in any case, Winston, we're here to talk about the protests in the North in Belfast.
Well, you talked about the state-sponsored.
Yes, I did.
Let's talk about the state-sponsored in terms of the Irish state.
No, but you were talking about
what happened in Northern Ireland.
Well, we can talk about that on another instance.
Recognition. We have seen the British government acknowledge very publicly and magnanimously for their role in any state-sponsored activity.
Well, I'm not sure if that's the case. We'd have to have that put to the people who are involved in it. But we were talking about respect for people's culture. I mean, you mentioned Britishness.
Cameron wasn't involved in that, but he apologised for it.
Okay, well, we were talking about the protests in Belfast, and your own leader mentioned this idea of Britishness, and you mentioned yourself the idea of culture as well. I mean, you said that there was councils set up as well that the IRA had involvement in, but these protests, the PSNI have said they're in no doubt whatsoever that the shots that were fired at the Moor by members of the UVF. How do you respond to that? The shots that were fired at the PSNI during some of the protests, the PSNI said they were in no doubt at all that it was from members of the UVF.
If I were you, I would be extremely careful about facts in which you're broadcasting at the moment, because quite clearly you haven't done your research very well. There were no shots.
This is the PSNI said this. This is media reports have stated this.
I'm sorry. Again, I would encourage you to go back and actually check exactly what happened. There was no live rounds fired at all during the protests.
On any of them. So why did the PSNI mention this then?
Well, because they said that they believed that there was shots fired, and they had an investigation, and they realized within 24 hours that there were no shots fired.
Indeed. And thank you very much to all the participants. Jim McVeigh, Sinn Féin councillor, David McElveen, DUP MLA, Conal McDevitt, SDLP MLA, Laura McNamee, Alliance Party councillor for East Belfast, and Winston Irvine from the Progressive Unionist Party. So thank you very much to all of them for taking part. And that was just our synopsis, our special feature of the fortnight about the Belfast riots. So that's it from me, Peter Carney. The show will, if you're listening on Tuesday, you're listening to it right now. I'm back then every Tuesday fortnight, 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. with international politics. So looking forward to chatting to you then.